Great. So you've stayed in for church history. If that's not what you're expecting, then you're in the wrong room. But we're looking at church history. I'm going to read a couple of verses just from Romans chapter 1 that we'll come back to later on this evening. Romans 1, verse 16 and 17. This is the Apostle Paul writing, and he said, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith." This is our second series, thinking about church history. We began back in the autumn. So if you want to catch up with those, they'll be available on YouTube or maybe audio on the website as well. And in that track last autumn, we considered really the early church, right from the end of the book of Acts through to about 450 AD. Thought about the growth and expansion of the church through that particular time. We thought about some of the early defenders of the gospel, those who kind of gave a reasoned approach for why the gospel was true and why it was a rational, reasonable thing to believe. They gave a defense of Christianity to the sort of Roman Empire. We saw the response of the Roman Empire to the church. It was a mixture of kind of persecution, severe persecution at times, and then particularly under Constantine, moving more toward support for the church. We looked as well at some of the early theological controversies there were, some of the creeds and councils that we would refer back to even today, which looked really to sort of clarify biblical truth at that time, particularly about the person of Christ, about who Christ is as fully God and fully man. And along the way, we saw some major figures like Athanasius and Augustine. Well, as we pick up this second series, what we're going to do is we're going to jump forward about 1,000 years now, and we're going to spend our time focusing on the Reformation. Now, don't get the idea then that there's nothing to say about the progress of the kingdom for about 1,000 years. That's not really the case. One book I've recommended, which gives a sort of, for those of you who kind of want to read a bit more about this at a sort of overview level, a starter level, is a book called Sketches from Church History by S.M. Houghton. To be honest, I don't know if it's still in print, but I've still got a copy that I've nicked from my in-laws. But it's if you can get hold of a copy of that, I'm sure it'll be available somewhere. That's been a really helpful kind of introductory book. And if you do get hold of that, you will see there's plenty happening after the time of Augustine, always through to about 1500, which is where we're going to get to. Now, it's not always good stuff that's happening, but there were some significant steps, particularly from our perspective, the coming of Christianity to Britain, for example. But we're going to jump forward to the Reformation, and why focus on that? Well, when you talk about Reformation, it is one of the great events of human history. Those of you who are historians in the room, I won't ask you to raise your hand because then I'll just feel like I'm a bit nervous speaking to you. But I'm sure there are some historians in the room. It is one of the great events of human history. It affected the course of Western society. So it was a significant watershed moment. And we are still living with the consequences, the ripples of what happened back then. And I guess if you want in really sort of simple summary terms, if the early church grappled with and kind of clarified the doctrine of who Jesus was, his identity as fully God and fully man, then the Reformation grappled with and clarified the doctrine of the work of Christ, that salvation is by grace alone, by faith alone, in Christ alone. Let me give you three sort of perspectives just to bear in mind as we come to think about the Reformation over these few weeks. These all came out of a lecture series that I did in my sort of Bible college days on the Reformation, but I think they're helpful for just kind of guiding our thinking as we work through this. First thing is to appreciate that history is a story of sinners who are used by God. So the heroes are always flawed heroes. That's the reality. We will see that with some of the men who are most greatly used in God's purposes, men like Martin Luther or John Calvin. They were still sinners. They were not perfect. Which reminds us, I think, that we don't expect anyone to be perfect. We don't expect anyone not to make mistakes, even bad mistakes. Even the best people have their blind spots. And I guess if we were to write people off when they have their failings, well, then we would write everybody off. There'll be nobody left. God is in the business of using flawed people in his purposes. And that's what we see through the history of the church. Second, I think another thing we can recognize is that God uses secondary things to further the cause of the kingdom. What I mean by that is that he uses things like the economic situation or the political events of the time to bring about his purposes. Now, we'll see some of that tonight. We'll see that particularly in the English Reformation in a couple of weeks' time. We'll see today there were circumstances in the politics and culture of the day that meant when Martin Luther sort of lit the fuse, if you like, for the Reformation, that the fire was ready to catch hold and the Reformation spread at that time. A third perspective is to see that even small events can have big effects. So one of the major events, one that we're going to come to and talk about next week, is the famous nailing of 95 theses, doctrinal statements, to a church door by Martin Luther. But Luther has no idea when he does that he is starting something so major with that particular event. That is not in his mind as he does it. A couple of weeks' time, we'll see the affair of the sausages. So who knew that the humble sausage would be so significant in the history of the church? But we'll get to that when we talk about the Reformation in Switzerland. So let's talk about a little bit of the sort of background to the Reformation. Where were things at when the Reformation took place? So four important background issues to be aware of. I'm going to talk about the political situation, the ecclesiastical situation, in other words, where the church was at, technological situation, and then the intellectual, just to set some context and to see why the Reformation was important. So first up, the political. Charles V became Holy Roman Emperor in 1519, which means he controlled pretty extensive territory across Europe. And as Holy Roman Emperor, he was also the upholder of Christianity from a kind of political point of view. Now, Charles, when he came into power, was battling on two major fronts. He was battling with Francis I, who was King of France in the West, one side. And then in the East, he was fighting with the Turks. Their leader was Suleiman the Magnificent. And if you have a name like that, you're bound to be a political leader, aren't you? You're certainly going to rise to that position. Now, the reason that matters, that Charles V was fighting on those different fronts, is Charles has an awful lot on his plate. He's fighting war after war, and dealing with this monk, Martin Luther, is just one of his issues. So at the point when Martin Luther is actually most vulnerable, about 1519 to 1521, Charles has just taken up his role and he's got loads of other things to be dealing with. And that was really helpful for Luther. Let's talk about the ecclesiastical situation. In other words, what was the state of the church at the time of the Reformation? Well, firstly, there was structural weakness. There was confusion of leadership. The popes were seen as having spiritual authority. They had the spiritual authority, emperors had the political one. But popes tended to get entangled in political affairs. So there was a real kind of confusion of leadership. And it got even worse when for a season there were two popes. So the English and English allies, they were supporting a Roman pope, and the French and their allies were supporting a French pope. It was kind of known as the Great Schism. It was about 40 years of that, about 100 years before Martin Luther was on the scene. And as one historian put it, the papacy had then sunk very deep in the polls. Basically, with two popes, it's like, who has spiritual authority? Who's in charge here? That was a structural kind of weakness. There was also lots of moral corruption. So let me take you through some of those. First up, this term called simony, the buying and selling of church offices. The buying and selling of church positions. Now, it wasn't the official position of the church that you could do that, but it was an abuse of the system. So church offices were not considered on the basis of spiritual qualification. They were bought and sold. They were like investments. So for example, a guy called Albert of Brandenburg in Germany was Archbishop of two places and Bishop of another place. That was his bishop portfolio of investments. Which led to this issue, pluralism or absenteeism. It's clear that if you've got people who are holding multiple offices, Well, they can't all be in the place of all the different places where they were supposed to be having spiritual oversight. They couldn't be in all those places at the same time. So people were not showing up to offer any spiritual leadership. There's an example of one French archbishop who only visited his patch once in his entire life. Responsibility of spiritual oversight wasn't taken seriously. And then there was a breakdown of celibacy. So celibacy was the requirement of the clergy at that time, but a good number of clergy felt they couldn't maintain that. So they lived in effect with a spouse, a concubine, and that was kind of accepted. The bishop would basically charge a fee to overlook this arrangement and to legitimise any children that came along. So just to give you some idea, official documents from the 16th century showed that 25% of all the clergy in Netherlands and 33% of all those in southern Germany were living with concubines. So interesting then that what we're talking about is corruption in the church in terms of power, money and sex. Which shouldn't really come as such a big surprise to us, that are always the kind of issues that we can be wrestling with. Shouldn't surprise us particularly when we see the same kind of things occurring today. But alongside that sort of, if you like, what's happening in the sort of authorities of the church, we could talk about lay piety. In other words, what was the sort of common Christian? What was their sort of situation? Well, you could say it was intense, but it was misguided. So there was not a lot of orthodox belief in the gospel, but there was lots of expressions of piety, lots of expressions of sort of devotion, but not always in a great direction. So, for example, there was lots of superstition, lots of a veneration of the saints, as an example. Lots of groups had their own patron saint. I'll talk about that with Luther a bit later on. There was lots of devotion to Mary, Jesus' mother, particularly intense around this kind of period. And veneration of relics, sort of objects associated with a religious person of the past, that kind of stuff. And so the clergy were not directing people to anything better at that. There were some attempts at reform, so not everything was corrupt, but certainly there was a general sort of illiteracy amongst people. There was a dependence on the clergy who were mixed at best, corrupt at worst. And it didn't, none of that pointed the common person to sort of what true religion should look like. We could ask why there was such religious devotion when we live in an age when there is, if you like, more limited religious devotion. And it's helpful to recognise most people were living in very sort of rural agricultural contexts. So, for example, only about 50,000 people lived in London in 1500, just 50,000. It was 10 times that 200 years later. But most at this time are living in a situation where the pressures of life are really intense, the economy is very fragile, risk of agricultural failure was a massive thing, and that type of life being very fragile. So something like 50% of people died before the age of 10, just to set some kind of context. Very limited medicine. Food not good, no dentistry, all of those kind of things, which all meant there was a much more immediate threat of death. That was a much more kind of present reality for people. And it was understandable, therefore, that these sort of expressions of piety would be really important. So people could easily be persuaded to put their hope, their confidence, their trust in these kind of superstitions, rituals, in dead saints. So that was the situation of the church. Let me talk about the technological sort of situation, and particularly about the printing press. The first printed book was produced in mid-800s in China, but Europe had to wait until mid-15th century. So the printing press was invented in 1454 in Germany by Johann Gutenberg, and the first completed book was printed a couple of years later. That was 1456, and that was the Bible. Now, that sort of new ability to print was kind of kept secret in the city where all this was developed. But the city was raided, and basically all the printers kind of got scattered. And so 20 years later, you had all these guys who'd been printing, ending up in different parts of Europe, and all these printing presses kind of developed, scattered around. So by the time Martin Luther was born, 1483, printing was an established thing across Europe. And as we'll see, the printing press was really crucial in the way the Reformation was able to take hold. Last thing by way of background is the sort of intellectual situation. And I want to talk about Renaissance humanism. You can impress your friends with Renaissance humanism this week when you have a chat. For some time, the kind of prevailing intellectual idea had been something called scholasticism. From sort of 1200 through to about 1500, scholasticism is defined by one historian in this way. It was a medieval movement which put an emphasis on rational justification of belief and a systematic presentation of those beliefs. In other words, it was very rational, it was very logical, it was very sort of ordered, very much of the mind. It was a lot about making fine, subtle distinctions. So it had a reputation of being quite dry, based on very sort of logical reasoning, and would debate somewhat obscure and somewhat irrelevant things. So, for example, one question that got debated was how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? That was one of the big issues they were wrestling with. Now, today you might hear that question, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? And you might think that's a joke and you're waiting for the punchline. But in the days of the scholastics, that would have been a serious question they'd have been wrestling with. So the reaction to that was Renaissance humanism. Now, it's different to the humanism of today, which is kind of secular humanism, and that rejects the whole idea of God. Now, Renaissance humanism was a different kind of movement. And it's important because a load of the reformers were influenced and taught sort of this Renaissance humanism. They had training in it. And one definition of it is this. It was a movement which placed emphasis on eloquence and it appealed to classical antiquity. In simple terms, it emphasized going back to the source documents. It had an emphasis on going back to the original languages that the Bible was written in, going back to the original sources, not just the commentaries on those things. And also that language was not just a kind of rational thing, but it was also to be used to move hearts and minds. So that approach was kind of a helpful movement, I guess. And one of the leading lights of it is the picture up on the screen, a guy called Erasmus. So he was around sort of born 20 years or so before Luther. There was a saying in the 16th century that Erasmus laid the egg and Luther hatched it. So Erasmus is a kind of important forerunner, an important individual to consider. He was born in the Netherlands. He was called the Prince of the Humanists. He was an illegitimate son of a priest, but he had a great education. He was educated in Paris, in Cambridge, in Oxford. And while he was at Oxford, he met a guy called John Collett. And Collett was the one who persuaded Erasmus to give his time to biblical studies. That's where his sort of intellectual effort and energy came to. And Erasmus really made two pretty major contributions which laid some foundations for the Reformation. So the first is that he wrote against the abuses and corruption that were happening in the church. He wrote about the misdirected sort of hopes that people were placing their trust in these religious ceremony and performance for salvation. So he wrote in this book, The Praise of Folly. I'm going to give you a longish quote from The Praise of Folly, just to give you the kind of idea of what he was trying to expose. It will be pretty to hear their pleas before the great tribunal. In other words, this is what people are going to say when they come before the judgment seat. One will brag how he mortified his carnal appetite by feeding only upon fish. Another will urge that he spent most of his time on earth in the divine exercise of singing psalms. A third will tell how many days he fasted and what severe penance he imposed on himself for the bringing his body into subjection. Another shall produce in his own behalf as many ceremonies as would load a fleet of merchant men. A fifth shall plead that in 80 years he never so much as touched a piece of money, except he touched it through a thick pair of gloves. A sixth, to testify his former humility, shall bring along with him his sacred hood, in other words, his cloak and his hood, so old and nasty that any sailor would rather stand bareheaded on the deck than put it on to defend his ears in the sharpest storm. The next that comes to answer for himself shall plead that for 50 years together he'd lived like a sponge upon the same place and was content never to change his homely habitation. Another shall whisper softly and tell the judge he has lost his voice by a continual singing of holy hymns and anthems. The next shall confess how he fell into a lethargy by a strict, reserved and sedentary life. And the last shall intimate, notice he shall intimate, that he has forgot to speak by having always kept silence in obedience to the injunction of taking heed, lest he should have offended with his tongue. But amidst all their fine excuses, our Saviour shall interrupt them with this answer, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, verily I know you not." It gives us a kind of picture of the level of kind of superstition that was going on at the time and how Erasmus wanted to unmask that and expose that. So that was one of the things he did. He spoke against kind of this legalism in the church. And then secondly, he edited a Greek New Testament. That was published in 1516. And in his kind of introduction to that New Testament, he wrote this. "I would to God the ploughman would sing a text of the scripture at his ploughbeam, and that the weaver at his loom, with this would drive away the tediousness of time. I would the wayfaring man with this pastime would express the weariness of his journey, and to be sure, I would that all the communication of the Christian should be of the scripture." In other words, he wanted the common man to have access to what the Bible says. So certainly Erasmus was a really important forerunner to the Reformation, but he didn't bring it about. So Martin Luther said of Erasmus that he had pointed out all of the evil, but he is unable to point out the good. That was how he described it. It took Martin Luther and others for the Reformation to happen. And it's Martin Luther that we're going to turn and consider now. So we're going to really think about sort of Martin Luther in his early days and to the point in which he was converted. One church history lecturer, Frank James, said there is more written about Martin Luther than any other man except for Jesus Christ. Luther was certainly larger than life. He was bold, he was bright, he was boisterous, he was certainly courageous. And it wasn't that he kind of planned and set out to put the Reformation into place. So he didn't set out to achieve it, but Martin Luther was certainly the spark. The circumstances were right, and the Reformation took hold. Well, he was born on 10th of November 1483 in Eisleben, Germany. He was born to parents who were domestic servants. So he was born as a peasant rather than in a privileged upbringing. He was one of eight children, four girls, four boys. He was son number two in the list. And it was not long after Martin was born that the family moved to Mansfield in Germany, as opposed to Mansfield up the road, which was the centre of Germany's mining industry. Martin's father was a guy called Hans Luder. Martin changed the spelling to Luther later on in life. But Hans was an ambitious man, and when Luther was about 9 years old, Hans borrowed some money, he bought a copper mine, and he became a successful miner. And therefore, he was better off than most other peasants of his sort of peer group. And as a result of that relative wealth, Martin could be given a decent education. So he went, age 12, to boarding school, and then 1501, age 18, he went to university in a place called Erfurt. Now, he was certainly an able student. So he graduated as early as he could from university. He came second in his class of 17 students. Now, the aim of getting that university education was that he was then going to train to be a lawyer. That was certainly the sort of intention of his father. That's what his dad wanted him to do. So in May 1505, he started at law school, though it seems that that wasn't really what Martin himself wanted to do. It seemed at this kind of point, he started to become more, to consider theology more, and to get more serious about religion. So Sidney Houghton records that one day during his studies, he came across a copy of the Bible, which he'd never seen before, and he was moved as he read it, particularly by the story of Hannah and Samuel at the beginning of 1 Samuel. It was around this time that one of his friends had been killed in a fight. So various things were kind of just making him think more seriously about religion and about theology. Well, Martin had taken a trip home to discuss his future with his father. They went to have a chat. Martin wanted to switch over from doing law to studying religion. And at that time, that would basically mean that Martin would become a monk. Now, his father basically says, no way that's going to happen. You need to go back to the law. So Martin is on his journey, on his way back to law school. And as he's on the journey back, there's a furious thunderstorm. And lightning strikes really close by to where Martin is. He throws himself down on the ground and he cries out to St. Anne, "Help Anna, beloved saint, I will become a monk." And he made his vow to become a monk. Well, he did keep his vow, and soon after he entered a monastery, despite the fact his father was still very unhappy about it. Now, it is interesting that St. Anne was the patron saint of miners. So in the scheme of things, that might have made his father a little bit more wary about Martin breaking his vow. He wanted his mine to be, his copper mine to be successful. Anyway, it's 1505. Martin has entered this monastery and he begins studies in theology at the university. Now, worth saying, when it came to entering a monastery, you had a few choices, a few different streams. You could go for the Dominicans, you could go for the Franciscans, or you could go for the Augustinians. And the Augustinians were the strictest and most demanding. And that's the one that Martin went for. And by all accounts, he was a pretty serious and a zealous monk. It seems that those events of nearly being struck by lightning, his friend's death, all of those have contributed to him taking his relationship with God really seriously. So he was very scrupulous about following all of the different monastic rules, which meant things like this. It meant devotion to prayers. So he appealed to 21 dead saints, praying to three of them each morning. He would fast regularly. He would perform acts of menial service. There were ascetic practices like self-flagellation or enduring extreme cold. There was a real impact to his own physical well-being. All of those activities designed, he thought, to secure and gain salvation. The older monks apparently became frustrated with him because he kept coming along to confess very little things. There was this whole spiritual anxiety over his sin and plagued by doubts that he was doing enough to merit and gain salvation. But we spent a bit of time tonight thinking about the finished work of Christ that we rest on. So even actually after he became clear on justification by faith, it's not that all of his spiritual anxieties vanished. But there was certainly an intensity at this time. Now, he received some help from a guy called John von Staupitz. Von Staupitz was the head of the Augustinian order in Germany, and from time to time he would make his way to the monastery. And Luther and von Staupitz became friends, and Luther would say to him something like, "Oh, my sins, my sins, my sins." And von Staupitz would reply, "Remember that Christ came into the world for the pardon of sins." And when Luther would be terrified at the prospect of Christ as a judge, Staupitz would say to him, "Look at the wounds of Christ, and you will see there shining clearly the purpose of God toward men." Now, in terms of when his conversion actually came, it seems that although Luther himself spoke of a sort of sudden conversion in one of his later commentaries, it seems likely that sort of through the period of 1514 to 1519, so when he's in his early 30s, he gradually got clear with a kind of series of insights about what the gospel was. And we'll see that the really important step on the 31st of October, 1517, nailing the theses to the door, comes right during that period. But one of his key breakthroughs comes in understanding the phrase, the righteousness of God, from the verses we've just read in Romans 1:17. Now, Luther had thought about that text in regard to God's unchanging hatred and opposition to sin. But as he considered the phrase in Romans 1:17, he came to see this, that the gospel reveals the righteousness of God in this way, that there is a righteousness that God counts to the believer for the sake of the righteousness of Christ. In other words, the gospel is about receiving a righteousness from God, the righteousness that we need to gain from him, not a righteousness we produce for him. He began to see the truth of the gospel as it's put in Romans 4:5, that it's to the one who does not work but trusts God who justifies the ungodly, their faith is credited as righteousness. He saw that faith is the way that we gain this righteousness. Not all these acts of devotion, not all these sort of ascetic practices. It was a righteousness which is given and not earned. And so writing in 1545, as he reflecting back on this, he said, "All at once I felt I had been born again and entered into paradise itself through open gates. Immediately I saw the whole of Scripture in a different light." So that dawning understanding he had of justification by faith, not by works, it's known as the evangelical breakthrough. Now, before all that, he had been progressing in terms of his teaching and his responsibilities. He'd been ordained in 1509. He received his doctorate in 1512. He'd become professor of biblical studies at 1512, all before he'd been converted. And it's at Wittenberg that the crucial moment comes for the Reformation, 31st of October 1517. But we'll talk about that next time. Let me draw just a few sort of conclusions and applications from what we've seen. First up, I guess, as we reflect back on what we've seen, ahead of the Reformation taking place, a load of things made the world ready for such an event. So as we've seen, the kind of political situation, the intellectual atmosphere, even the technological situation of the time, meant that when Luther rediscovered a biblical gospel, when he saw the goodness of God's grace, when he saw the importance of justification by faith, that the wider context of what was going on meant it didn't just take hold with Luther, but it rolled out into others. So Luther was a spark, but there was fuel ready to catch hold, ready to catch fire. And I think that should encourage us to recognise that the Lord is always at work in loads of different areas of life to see his kingdom established and his kingdom moving forward. So the church is the absolute heart of his focus. The church is the absolute heart of what God's about today. Now, that's the news report in heaven today. It's what's happened in the church as the church has gathered today. But all the things going on in the world are for the good of his church and the progress of his kingdom. So whether or not we like the political landscape, whether or not we are nervous about where technology is heading, whether the intellectual winds seem to be kind of blow more or less in line with biblical ideas, the Lord is at work through all those things, whatever's going on. Which means we shouldn't despair or lose heart, whatever we see going on in the world. We shouldn't ever believe the world is spinning out of control. The Lord is always governing and he's always ruling. And even if there are years, even if there are decades, even centuries where it seems like there's not lots of good progress being made, God's always in charge and working out the purposes of his kingdom. The second thing I think we can see, particularly in the conversion of Martin Luther, is that a long season of kind of struggle or conviction of sin or struggling to get clear on the gospel is not necessarily a bad thing. The gospel was really precious to Luther because he'd really seen how empty all the man-made ways of salvation were. That's why it was so precious to him. Now, he was as devoted and as earnest before he became a Christian as anyone could be, and yet he'd found no peace, no rest for his soul until he found Christ in his righteousness. But his wrestling about that was not over a weekend, not over a couple of weeks. It was years and years of grappling with those things before the light of the gospel shone in his heart. You know, at one level, as we see people kind of wrestling to get the gospel, we should not be discouraged by that, but maybe encouraged that God is doing a deep work in them. That actually, as they've despaired over their own sin, as they've wrestled with conviction, it may be that the gospel then will be all the more precious. Those who share the gospel most readily with others, most eagerly with others, are those who know how precious it is to them. And a third thing, and a final application. Let's give thanks for the righteousness of Christ freely given to us. Not given to us tonight as a result of religious duty, not because we've listened to a talk on church history, that will not gain you merit before Christ tonight. But salvation is freely given to us as a grace, as a gracious gift of God to be received. Not a prize to be earned, it's not merit to be won, but it's gift of grace always. The gospel that we hold here and that we teach here and that we believe the Bible teaches is the gospel of God's grace. That was not a gospel that was discovered at the Reformation, but it was a gospel uncovered again. The Reformation didn't sort of decide this is what the gospel is. It was rediscovering what the scriptures had always taught, put the gospel of God's grace back in focus, this liberating ancient truth that Christ and the apostles taught, that it's salvation by grace alone, through Christ alone, through faith alone. And a gospel tonight which leaves us deeply assured that we're at peace with God. That was the problem for Luther, wasn't it? He had no peace, he had no assurance whatsoever. Your peace and your assurance tonight does not rest on what you do, but on what Christ has done for you. That's why we're confident. That's why having assurance is a distinctly kind of Reformation thing, if you like. That assurance is what the Bible teaches us we can have, because our confidence doesn't rest on in us, but it rests on the finished work of Christ himself. We're going to take a moment to see.